In this episode, we have got Dr. Sarah Wickham back. Oh yes, hold on to your hats as you are in for a treat. Sarah's newest book, titled In Your Own Time, How Western Medicine Controls the Start of Labour and Why This Needs to Stop, is a masterclass in what the evidence really says about induction of labour and a fascinating insight into how birth has come to be controlled by Western medicine. Staggeringly, over a third of all pregnant women have their labour medically induced, and this is accompanied by a tsunami of avoidable medical interventions. Worldwide, this trend is growing at an alarming rate. This is despite both a lack of evidence demonstrating its benefits and a wealth of evidence indicating the significant short and long-term negative impacts of induction on the health and well-being of mothers and their babies. Sarah discusses with us in the cauldron how her timely book, in light of the newly released NICE Inducing Labour Guidelines, demystifies the evidence and highlights the significant discrepancies between guidelines and what we really know about the benefits of supporting women to birth spontaneously. Dr. Sarah Wickham is a midwife, speaker, best-selling author and researcher who works independently. Sarah's career has been varied and includes more than 20 years of experience as a midwife, lecturer and researcher. She is the author, editor of 17 books and is the director of the Birth Information Project. She divides her working time between speaking, writing, facilitating online courses, creating fantastic resources, and undertaking a wide variety of consultancy projects and advisory activities. This is an episode you definitely want to get your hands on. Also, if you love this podcast like we know you do, don't forget to subscribe to it. That means it pops up automatically in your mobile phone before you even need to think about it. Please also go over to Apple or any of the other podcast hosts and give us a rating and a review. And also check out how you can support the show on our Patreon page or our other donation sites. Right, let's get into the show, huh? Here we go. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. Sarah, it is an absolute delight to have you back in the cauldron with us. We are so pleased. It is very exciting. And I know that everyone listening is going to be super excited. The feedback we had when you put on your Instagram whether you should come back in the cauldron, people were rather excited on the Midwives Cauldron Instagram and also Rachel's, and I'm assuming on yours as well. So
indeed.
That is marvelous. You are here, one, because we love having you, but also because you have written a new book. And I would like to, if I can, is just read the first paragraph from the back of the book, because I think this just says a lot. And it says, pregnant women and maternity services are facing an induction epidemic. As medical guidelines include more at-risk categories, women and are already overwhelmed and under-resourced maternity services are increasingly pressured to induce birth before labour begins spontaneously. Women are deemed to be too large and too old, while babies are estimated to be too big and too overdue. But is better out than in really a safer option than waiting to birth in your own time? And for me, this book, which you have titled In Your Own Time, How Western Medicine Controls the Start of Labour and Why This Needs to Stop, is a synopsis, it's not even a synopsis because that's part of the nerve and the brain cells. It's a synopsis. It's a tiny golden nugget of what this incredible book is about. And that's why we wanted to bring you back on. There is so much to discuss. There's been a lot going on.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's lovely to be back. I truly had no idea when we chatted, I can't remember when it was, back in May or June about Auntie D Explained. I didn't even know I was going to write another book, let alone come back and talk to you about it in November. So, yeah. but it's very lovely to be here and to see you both. And yeah, thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.
You must have been very busy writing a book in between.
Do you know what? I was gonna have a rest and sit in my garden after I wrote Auntie D Explained, because it was the summer and I thought this would be great. I've got a nice garden sofa. I'll sit there and I'll kind of catch up. But then that didn't happen.
Why was that? Was there anything that may have triggered that?
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, of course, the catalyst was the draft NICE guidance on induction of labour, which came out in May this year, which is 2021, in case people, I'm sure people will still be listening to in 5 years' time and 10 years' time. and the draft NICE guidance, it always goes out in draft form before it becomes a final guideline. And the draft guidance, I mean, like many people, I was horrified at what was in there. And about how they weren't rooted in the evidence about induction or the wider context. So they hadn't taken women's experiences and views into account. A lot of the recommendations were based on so-called expert knowledge rather than evidence. And there's nothing wrong with expert knowledge. It's great. And, you know, but it's not necessarily what we want to base national guidance on. And so, you know, yeah, like many people, I was really concerned. And actually, the first thing I did was to write a huge blog post summarising the problems, because so many people were getting in touch with me and saying, you know, you've done so much work on induction. It was my PhD back in 2008. And that was the culmination of, you know, several years work analysing the evidence. And I've actually not been able to move on from that really ever since. I would quite like to talk about things, but I keep being brought back to induction because it's an ongoing issue. And so I wrote a huge blog post, like literally in a couple of days, because so many people and organisations were contacting me asking for help and support to put their response to NICE together. And in fact, I don't need to say more about that, because that blog post is still on my website if anyone's interested. So there's no point taking up our time talking about that. My website is sarahwickham.com. And if you just scroll down the first page, you'll see it's called 10 Reasons to Question the Draft NICE Guideline. But the thing is that although the NICE guidance in a way was a catalyst for me writing this book, I'd actually got a list of about five books that I wanted to write on induction. I just hadn't decided which one of those I was going to write first, and they were all different things. And the fact is that the NICE guidance, the draft guidance, was just the catalyst. A good many women were already being offered induction when there wasn't good evidence for it. Mm. That had been increasing. And the fact is that even if the proposed guidance was toned down, which thankfully it was, as people may know, the things that were in the draft guidance did not all make it to the final guidance. And we should be thankful for that. But there are still some significant issues with the final guidance, which I can speak to in a bit if you'd like me to. Mm. But we still have a significant problem, because there was already an induction epidemic before the draft guidance mm-hmm. came out. It literally was just the catalyst. And it's getting worse. And so many women and families are being told that they need to have their labour induced. And often it's because of perceived risk, for which the evidence for intervention is generally either marginal or non-existent, and not because they have an actual problem or medical condition in which the benefits of induction might, for them, and it's always their decision, genuinely outweigh the risk. Mm. So instead of sitting on my sofa in the garden, I wrote the book, because I just thought, I mean, I've already written one book about induction. I've written a book called Inducing Labour, Making Informed Decisions. And that was really about helping women and families to think about whether or not induction was right for them or is right for them. But I realised we needed another book. We needed a book that explained why we have the problem that we have now with induction. Mm. Which talks about the benefits of spontaneous labour, rather than us always being on the back foot and trying to explain why induction isn't the answer. I felt like, well, we need something. This was one of my five books and it became a chapter. All of my five books I was going to write, they're all in there. It's just that they're a chapter now rather than a book. It was like, let's just do it all in one go. To help people understand the deeper issues, but also to write about some of the specific issues that we're facing today, like the issue of big babies, induction mm-hmm. being offered to women who are older and larger, the things that you were saying in when you were reading the back of the book, Katie, because if we're going to challenge the induction epidemic, then we need more people to understand the deeper issue. So really that was my aim.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
Huge aim. And you did it. You really did.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how. I will say that I'm now going to sit on my sofa basically until Christmas.
Oh, yeah. And then there'll be another book.
And then you're going to contact us in February.
Oh, I really hope not, because I'm actually really tired. But we'll see. We'll see. Who knows?
That is one hell of a turnaround, Sarah. Like 6 months, not even, to complete a book that was five books that you've then put into one as well.
Do you know what? I do have to say, I should say this now, that I didn't do it alone. Books are never done alone. In fact, as we're recording this week, I am, putting out on Instagram just pictures of just a few of the people that helped me. When I decided I was going to give it a go, I phoned up, my two favourite editors, who are Julie Froelich and Nadine Edwards, and both of them, even though they're really busy, they've helped all summer. I mean, read it as I wrote. At one point, Julie was on our sofa with the cat reading and editing in one room while I was amending in another. Beverly Beach, bless her, was sat waiting for it to come through the door and proofread. And there's a whole load of people who have helped to make it happen in such a short amount of time. And I've named them all in the book. I don't want to start naming them and forgetting people on here, but I've named them all. So yes, books are always a team effort.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. It's not an easy and quick task, really.
And Julie wrote a fabulous foreword as well. I should mention that, which is just so great, because as a consultant midwife, I mean, one of the biggest issues, it's not just what the evidence says. That's really important. But the problem that we have, with the induction epidemic is that one of the big concerns about the proposed new guidelines and even the guidelines that have come out now is that more women are going to be offered induction. And again, that was already happening. It's happening in the UK, it's happening in other countries. Maternity services are already on their knees and they can't cope. And midwives that I know, who I speak to on the phone regularly, are having to phone women and say, I'm ever so sorry, but I know your induction was booked for tomorrow, but we don't have a bed for you. And the women say, oh, yeah, but I was told that my baby might die if I wasn't induced. Yeah. And this is mm-hmm. what women are being told. It sounds awful, and it's true. And the midwives, yes. well, I mean, the midwives know that that isn't true, that the baby is not, you know, is not at imminent risk, and that they know that the woman was coerced. And in fact, I have many quotes in the book from women and midwives and others, so it's all in there. But I mean, it's so wrong. It's wrong that women are being coerced into induction, where they're not being told the full truth. And then when they turn up, or as they're about to leave to go to the hospital, they're told, oh, oops, sorry. You know, I'm sorry someone put the fear of God in you in order to get you to come in, but actually there's not room for you here. You know, the system can't cope. The midwives can't cope. Everybody else in who's working there, you know, can't cope. It's an absolute quagmire. And women and families deserve so much better than they're being offered. It's also, I mean, I want to say it's not the fault of midwives or doctors. I mean, yes, there are some here and there who might be better in different careers. But the problem is the system and the structures and the ideas on which that's all based. It's racist, it's sexist, it's misogynistic, it's classist. You know, I know Rachel's written about some of this as well. It's rooted in really old political and economic structures which are designed to benefit just a few people. And we have to do whatever we can to get it to change. But we've really got to look at the problem in the system and how pressured the system is. And we can't go on.
And so where do the new NICE guidelines fit in that? Are they going to increase induction, do you think, or are they going to decrease induction?
Well, I mean, I think they are going to increase it, because even though some of the more, I don't want to say draconian, I don't think that's the right word, but even some of the stronger recommendations around induction at 39 weeks for different groups of women, including women who were larger, older than average, women who'd had IVF or ARTs, assisted reproductive technologies, and also shockingly, and I mean, I'm sure we'll come back to this, the suggestion of considering induction for maternal race. Even though those things were removed from the final guidelines, the updated guidance, it still kind of cements this ongoing shift towards normalising induction and bringing the end of labour forward. So, I mean, for instance, the NICE panel have suggested in the final guidance, and again, can I just note that there's a blog post on this on my website. So if anyone wants references or, you know, wants to see the actual quotes, that's available on sarahwickham.com. So they've suggested that induction should be offered from 41 weeks. That's my emphasis, rather than between 41 and 42 weeks, which is very subtle, but it will make a difference to the number of women being offered induction. And that's especially important when we look at the fact that that's when quite a lot of women go into labour and there's a margin of error involved with due dates. And the new guidance has also brought forward the offer of membrane sweeping to 39 weeks. And so for anyone that isn't aware, it used to be that membrane sweeping would be offered, because that's the word that is used, although we know in practice, in reality, it's not always presented as an offer. But membrane sweeping used to be offered at 40 weeks for women having their first baby, and at 41 weeks for women who had had a baby before for multiples. And it's now being offered to everyone at 39 weeks, which I have to say is a bit odd, because in the last guideline, which was 2008, there was a statement saying that we needed more evidence about membrane sweeping. And as far as I can see, Rachel, tell me if I've missed something. As far as I can see, there hasn't been more evidence.
No, but it's become a cultural norm. And in Australia, what happens even now in private practice is midwives are doing membrane sweeps from 39 weeks onwards to try and to get the woman over the line, so she doesn't end up in that you need to be induced, blah, blah, blah point. So it's already just becoming a normal part of antenatal care.
Absolutely. And when you talk to midwives who are working in the system, you can absolutely understand, you know, why midwives are like stuck between a rock and a hard place here, because they know what's going to happen. They know the pressure that's going to be put on women if they don't go into labour. But, you know, it's I'm just going back to, I suppose, to finish what I'm saying. It's hard to know how the new change, or how the change to offering membrane sweeping at 39 weeks is justified, given that the last guidance said we needed more evidence, and there hasn't been any more evidence.
Yeah.
There's just been this change. But I think it's also really important to be clear that membrane sweeping is a form of induction. It's not instead of induction. Mm-hmm. It is induction.
And it's not to avoid induction. It is induction.
Exactly. Induction methods can be mechanical or pharmaceutical, as we know. And membrane sweeping is a mechanical method of induction. You were asking about how the changes would affect the induction rate. And I'm not sure if this will affect the induction rate, but one of the concerns about the new guidance is that it also brings in this new recommendation about discussing preferences about mode of birth with women early on in pregnancy. And they want clinicians to mention induction and planned cesarean right at the beginning of pregnancy, which is new. And yeah,
it's all the grooming, isn't it? You're basically grooming compliance early on, talking about it and then introducing the membrane sweeping. It's all just undermining the woman and her trust in herself, in her body and her baby.
And even if you've got someone who isn't taking it as, let's start talking about this from the beginning of pregnancy, going back to what you said about the change in that language of offering induction between, and now it says from. And when you think about how busy we are, how we're trying to schedule appointments so close together at the end of pregnancy, what I can see is that this conversation starts happening at 38 weeks, 39 weeks, regardless, because they're thinking we need to start induction at 41 weeks. So from, not going any further, not that we're starting it, talking to it when she's post-term, so post 40 weeks. So again, it brings it much further forward, even if you've got someone who thinks this is really not appropriate to be talking about induction and planned cesarean at this early stage in their pregnancy.
And it's even worse than that in some areas, Katie, because I mean, I hear from many, many midwives and other people working in the system. In some areas, what's happening is that an induction date is being generated at booking.
And No way. So with their this is your estimated due date. And I really want to ask you about that because you wrote really well in the book. But also, so you get an estimated due date and then you get an induction date if you don't achieve, so to speak, your estimated due date.
Yeah. And it's all introducing doubt and undermining women's confidence in their bodies from the very beginning of pregnancy, And I suppose, to me, these are all examples of why I say that we have this trend towards normalizing induction, making it seem like this is just a very normal thing. And I mean, we in about 2 weeks from now, as we're recording, the NHS England, in fact, I think it's the UK, the maternity statistics will be coming out. And that will be the first time that we see, that the last statistic showed that the induction rate in the UK was about 30%. And actually, there's some research that was carried out over the pandemic, which I've written about in the book. And also, actually, I've written about that on my website as well. And that wasn't, I mean, that research was based on asking trusts to respond and what they were doing. So it's not representative of all trusts. It's based on who responded. So we know that might affect the findings, and it might be different when we look at the maternity statistics and look at all trusts and health boards across the UK. But what that shows is that the induction rate is rising. And I have obstetric colleagues who think that in their units it's been nearer 50% during the pandemic. And that's anecdotal. We don't yet have that evidence, but in a couple of weeks we're going to find out.
Wow. God, it's so frightening. And the thing is, it's not just the UK. It's globally, particularly in high-income countries, where we are seeing this massive increase. One in three women are being offered induction. And then we saw the paper that was released by Hannah Darlan and the team this year that looked at how around 15% of those that were offered were not for any medical reasons. And that's the other thing is, when we look at just induction, we need to take into account that women are probably given all these potential risk factors of if they don't induce their birth or if they go over dates. But are they being told the risk factors that are associated with them being induced? And that was interesting and fantastic to have that paper from Hannah Darlan and the team. And also you talk about that in your book and mention it.
Well, they're not. And they're also not having risks individualized for them. And I think that's an interesting point or important point that you make, Sarah, about the standardization of care. And that's what's driving this, is trying to standardize what we're doing for individuals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we live in this world that has become standardized. It's not just about maternity services or induction, where, you know, there's a one size fits all approach to so many things. But we're not all one size, you know, in any sense of the word. And actually, I use that phrase quite a lot in the book. So everyone should just get used to hearing that phrase from me. We are all individuals. Now, it's not that I'm promoting this individualist neoliberal approach, but we are all individuals, and we're not going to all want or need or benefit from the same thing. Mm. But the maternity services, like so many other industries these days, is based on this industrial Victorian era model of process management. That's the process management is a phrase I came up with when I wrote my PhD about this. And it describes how women are kind of processed and managed through the maternity services. And it's very inappropriate for lots of different reasons. And that's one of the things that we need people to understand. So basically, the people can decide whether they're happy to jump on the conveyor belt or whether they want something more personalised. And I mean, there's a bit in the book, I've got this written down, actually, because I actually put this quote up on Instagram and Facebook a couple of times. I wrote it in the book and I shared it before I published the book. And honestly, when I do that thing that everyone does where there's, you know, their 9 best, most popular posts in the year, I'm sure this is going to be in it. And I'll read it to you if that's all right. It says, I'm not anti-induction. I'm anti using limited and cherry-picked evidence and deceptive claims about risk to try and persuade entire groups of women to hand over control of their bodies and undergo intervention in the name of safety when the recommendations aren't based on good science or an understanding of the wider consequences of such actions and may cause harm. And I think that really sums up the problem, in that there are several different kind of facets to this problem, but it basically boils down to the fact that we are trying to make, or not we, but you know, those that there is this idea that we should make a recommendation, and everybody that fits into a particular group or category gets the same recommendation applied to them in this very standardized way. And yet you only have to go anywhere where there's a handful of people and you'll see that we're not all alike. And so the same thing isn't going to work for all of us in the same way.
Totally.
Absolutely. Gosh. And then how does that fit in with the issues of race? Because that was a huge backlash.
Oh, absolutely.
That went on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I suppose, you know, for anyone that doesn't know, the draft NICE guideline suggested that clinicians should consider offering induction at 39 weeks to anyone who was Black, Brown, Asian, or of mixed race. And that was because of the higher maternal mortality and stillbirth rates in those groups. And thankfully, that's one of the things that has been removed. Although I will say, I mean, I'd like to talk about that in a bit more depth if I may, but before I do, I'd like to say that, I mean, I am one of a number of people who are still concerned that there is still a paragraph in the final guideline under the bit about induction at 41 weeks mentioning that stillbirth rates are higher in those groups. And I'm one of the people that are concerned about what that's implying, because if that's there because there is a genuine desire to offer appropriate support to those groups, that's brilliant. But there's a lack of clarity and it's being left open to interpretation. And there's concern that some people are still going to take that as meaning, oh, actually offering induction is still a good thing. You know, there's already a postcode lottery out there. And this is, so when you look at guidelines, and, you know, as you know, Rachel will, well, you'll both know as well as I do, when you look at guidelines, it's actually, it's important not just to look at what is said, but at what isn't said. And as I said earlier in the podcast, we've already got induction, earlier induction being offered to older women, large women, you know, women with suspected big babies, all of those groups, even though there's a lack of evidence in most cases. And those are all topics that I really delve into the evidence in the book. So we know that the induction is being offered in those groups. So the change from the draft to the final guidance was, it removed the suggestion that induction should be offered at 39 weeks, but it didn't replace it with a suggestion or with a line that said, actually, there's no evidence for this. So it's kind of, does that make sense? It's kind of become ambiguous. And so we're concerned that in some areas, induction is still going to be offered because the guidance doesn't clearly say, look, there actually isn't any evidence, or here are the actual statistics. But I mean, to go back to maternal race, because this is, you know, I mean, it's just such an awful suggestion. I do want to say that I'm not an expert here. Like many people that I'm, you know, I'm still learning, but I couldn't not address this in the book and my blog post. It is really important to acknowledge that Black, Brown, Asian and mixed race women have poorer outcomes, as I said, for both mothers and babies than white women. I'm most familiar with the UK data, but I'm really aware from colleagues in Australia, New Zealand, for example, that they're seeing similar things, you know, with Aboriginal and Māori and Pacific Islander women in communities. And there are projects and studies like the Birthing on Country project, which have been specifically designed to address this inequality. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, Rachel.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in Australia, Aboriginal women and babies have horrendous outcomes in comparison. And where there's really good evidence of improved outcomes is where you have Aboriginal-led care, where Aboriginal women are leading their own care and they're working in their own communities. That is the best level of care. So it's really interesting, isn't it? Because we've got this problem. What's the solution? Oh, we'll just add in some medicine. We'll add in an intervention to a social cultural problem. It's not a medical problem.
Exactly. And, and you know, we know that the institutions like the maternity services are structurally and systemically racist. And we could all do with paying that a lot of attention. But as you say, it's induction isn't the answer. And there are so many reasons why not. There's no evidence that it'll help for a start. And of course, there are downsides to induction. Induction, offering induction, doesn't address the root cause of the problem. It would lead to more intervention. And we know that a part of the problem that Black and Brown people face generally in healthcare is that they're not listened to. So the last thing we want to do is to start exposing people, and again, not just in maternity care, but more widely. The last thing we want to do is to start exposing people who are already not listened to the risks of intervention, when if they then say, I'm in too much pain, I'm concerned about my well-being, I don't feel good, I'm worried about my baby, that they're not necessarily going to be heard. It's not logical, it's not kind, and it's not based on evidence. And I mean, I know, and I'd love to just mention this, because I know this is what people say. Some people are saying, but there is evidence that Black and Asian women in particular have shorter pregnancies, to which I would say, well, yes, there are some studies that show that. Again, I've talked about this in the book, but they're not robust studies. They often use racist language, which of course tells us quite a lot about the lens through which the research was carried out. They tended, partly because on the whole, they were carried out by white middle-class male obstetricians who were living in areas where they served, you know, white middle-class women. They tended to include many white women and just a few Black and Asian women. What? And the thing is that none of this takes into account the effects, the very long-term historical effects of inequalities or weathering. And weathering, if anyone doesn't know, weathering is a phenomenon where the constant microaggressions and racism that Black and brown people are exposed to ends up taking a toll on their health and well-being because they're constantly being stressed by microaggressions. And I mean, recently, in fact, it was perfect timing because I just managed to get it into the book. Christine Douglas and Amali Lokugamage wrote a BMJ blog about this, and they've explained it really well and in more detail than I've really got time to do. And as I said, I'm not an expert, but so have a look at their work. I can send you the link, or again, the reference is in the book for that. And I've shared it several times recently. I mean, I think overall, I can summarize my sense of what's going on in one sentence, which I wrote in the book. And it is that if weathering is the reason that Black and brown women have shorter pregnancies, if you look on a population basis, that isn't evidence for induction. It's evidence of racism. And that's what we need to tackle.
Mm. Wow. Gosh, I'm so lost for words with that, because it's such a scary statistic. But when you break it down like that, and that's what you guys are so good at doing, is really opening up. And it's like you're the watchmaker that takes the watches to pieces, and you examine every part to be able to put it back and make this watch work again, in terms of with guidelines and breaking them down so that all of us can understand that it isn't just, like you said, what's in the guideline, but what comes behind it. And so picking out these strands of this story is like blowing my mind. And the thing is, I have a certain amount of knowledge, but I'm not an expert, I don't know specifically those studies. And it's just, it's really difficult to take that on board. And it feels like that's a huge systemic problem that we have to challenge. And that's
why it's really important to not to look at the statistics and the outcomes, but look at the history or the her story and what is underpinning how things have got to where they are, and the lens that we're using to then examine the outcomes, because it's all linked. And I actually wanted to ask you, Sarah, for a bit of history about Marjorie Two. Or two. Now, I don't know how to say her name. I talk about her all the time, but what is it? Two? Two? What?
Well, I always say Marjorie Two, but I might be wrong. That there's, I don't have a monopoly on pronunciation. Well, I'm so glad that you just said what you did, Rachel, because I completely agree. And one of the things that I've tried to do in your own time is to mention some of the people that have been working in this area for several decades now, because this isn't a new problem. You know, birth activism hasn't been invented in the last 5 years, you know, and also to share the story of how we got to where we are today. I don't think the history of birth activism is being taught, and I think it should be, and not just because it's important to honour our foremothers and those who have kind of forged a path, but because there's actually so much that we can learn from their work, and we're otherwise reinventing the wheel. We, you know, we can see what worked and what didn't and where people struggled. And I think certainly for those who are trying to bring about change, it can really help us to see how, you know, where to target our actions. And so Marjorie Chu is one of the women that I've written about in the book, and she was a statistician who actually taught medical students to understand research. So no prizes for guessing why I'm a big fan of hers, because I do similar work. And what she did, and this was back in the 1970s, she was helping her students to look at some government papers that had been published and that were being used to kind of underpin the idea that women should all go into hospital to give birth, which in the UK did sort of start to happen in the 1970s. And Marjorie Chu looked at these papers and she looked at the data and realised that actually the conclusions that were being drawn from the data were wrong. That the things that the medical profession and the government were saying about the alleged safety of hospital birth compared to home birth, those things weren't supported by the data. Hospital wasn't safer than home. So Marjorie tried to bring this to light, because initially she thought, well, this is obviously a mistake. They've made a mistake. Everyone's entitled to make mistakes. We're not all statisticians, you know. So she took her findings to those that were, you know, looking at the data, and she was met with this complete resistance. And it actually took until 1985 before she could get a medical journal to publish her work. And it wasn't even one of the big medical journals. And by that time, hospital birth had become the norm. Mm-hmm. And it actually didn't really matter that her paper was published, because the idea that hospital birth was safer had become embedded into the culture. And as you both know now, there are lots of papers, I've actually shared one this morning, saying, you know, unless you truly have a medical condition, because that's always the caveat, you know, it's not about induction's never appropriate, it's just not appropriate, or intervention, it's just not appropriate across the board in a standardized way. You know, unless you have a genuine medical condition or a problem, home birth is just as safe as hospital birth. And it's quite mind-blowing when you think about it, because if Marjorie Chew had been listened to at the time, if her voice had been heard, if her analysis had been respected, then today there might only be a small number of women giving birth in hospital, though, you know, those who have a genuine problem or a need for it. The rest of us would all be giving birth at home with community-based midwives, have midwife-led care. You know, as Rachel was saying, you know, if you, you know, are in a particular group, Aboriginal women would have Aboriginal midwives, you know, appropriate care to who we are. And so much of this, of what I've just said about home birth, is true of induction as well. It wasn't brought in because there was good evidence for it. The evidence has always been marginal, particularly when induction is being offered because somebody is perceived to be at higher risk, you know. But there's a political element to all of this, and an economic element, of course. And the same thing is true of induction as for hospital birth. Once it's been established as the norm, you know, then it's seen as a good thing to do. Then people go along with it because they think it's safer. They actively request it. And that's not their fault. There's no blame here. But it's a travesty that women and families aren't being told the truth. They're not being told the truth about the risks of each option. They're not being told the truth about the reality of induction, about the alternatives, about the long-term effects. You know, they're not being given accurate information. They're often, so many of the stories that I've shared in the book are from women who have been given inaccurate, fear-based information about the risk of stillbirth, and it's not appropriate, and it's not fair. You know, the current approach, it undermines confidence. And I know I went off on a segue from there from talking about Marjorie's story, but I just think it's so important to look back at this history and to understand where it comes from and what's actually gone on in the past, how we've got to where we are. That's actually a whole chapter in the book.
And there's also this adding in of new technology, I think, to kind of build what's already happening and to support what's already happening, like ultrasound. You know, now we have ultrasound, we have all these ginormous babies that need to be induced because they're huge and, you know, they're going to break their mothers when they're being born. Ultrasound, we didn't have that.
This is a crazy thing because Rachel and I laugh because we know that this is ridiculous. And when I've done research with midwives, they laugh about this because it's such a ridiculous idea. But at the same time, it's not at all funny, because if you're not in the know, if you are not, you know, somebody that looks at this research and can understand maths, you have no idea that it's ridiculous. You believe these things that are true. You know, and both Rachel and I have written about, I mean, I've quoted Rachel very extensively on big babies because you did that fabulous blog post. As you know, I did email and say, can I quote you loads on this? Because there's no point reinventing the wheel. If somebody else has done the work, I'd much rather go, look, Rachel's done this fabulous work, go and have a look at it. You know, this is your blog post on big babies and care provider fear, you know, and you and I have both said the same thing in different ways at different times, which is, you know, it's kind of farcical because on the one hand, women are being told that their baby's just going to get bigger and bigger, you know, and then it's going to be too big and break their mother and won't come out and they're going to have a massive problem, for which, by the way, there isn't good evidence to suggest that induction is the answer to that or is or even is a problem. But at the same time, women, sometimes the same women, are being told, oh, but, you know, you can't really go too far after your due date because your placenta is going to fail and, you know, that's going to nourish your baby. Well, either your placenta is going to nourish your baby and make it too big and it's going to break up, or your placenta is going to fail and your baby's not going to be all right because the placenta is knackered. You can't have it both ways. You know, the technocratic model needs to decide which of these. And this is where we do need to look at this and break it down. It is, I often say that the research on induction and the theories, the myths, it is like a house of cards, because when you look at it in any depth, you see how it starts falling apart and how you have these two statements which are being told to thousands of women every week, and yet they are contradicting each other.
But when you're in that phase in your pregnancy and you've been through the system, you are unable to comprehend that they don't make sense, that you, if your placenta is failing, then my baby's not going to be growing really big. And, you know, which is it? What are the risks? What are the risks for me? I'm being told this. And it just leaves these women in a state of panic. And absolutely, how many women have I seen, friends have I seen, that have been told this information, frightened to death, and then absolutely, I'm going to put agree in quotes to having an induction because they're so scared. And where do we go from this? Because it's easy in a way for us to sit here and say this doesn't exist. There is this massive issue about big babies. Can you maybe speak to care providers and, you know, this whole aspect of big babies? Where do we go? What do we say? How can we make this not such a scare topic? What do we need to know as healthcare providers, and what should we be saying to women?
Well, I think one of the problems is once we've had the ultrasound, we found the thing out, even though you can't actually tell from an ultrasound how big a baby is, but we've now got that, and then that's what's worked on. But what the evidence, and this is what women need to understand, is that the evidence suggests or demonstrates that it's not the size of the baby that has the impact on the outcomes that are associated with big babies, like shoulder dystocias and perineal tearing. It's actually more knowing or thinking that the baby's big. So when the baby is perceived as being big, regardless of whether it actually is big or not, because often they're wrong, those babies and mothers are at increased risk of interventions and bad outcomes compared to those sneaky big babies who nobody knew they were big and they pop out. So there's something going on with what we're doing to women when we think they have big babies, and possibly how the women feel about themselves when they have been told that they have got big babies. So there's something going on that's not just about the size of the baby. And, you know, that's really important for women to understand.
And it's another way of introducing the doubt, isn't it? It's another way of going, oh, your baby's too, not sure if you're going to push this out, you know.
Absolutely. And I mean, planting that seed. Yeah. And it's an easy seed to plant. There is huge fear around this, understandably.
And can I share another of my favorite animal quotes? Because, you know, as you know,
as long as it's not an orangutan,
it's a hamster. It's a hamster.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of my favorite things, you know, that I wrote about in my first induction book and this one, is that when you look at the studies that looked at the difference in the weight of a baby between women who were induced early because they were told they'd got a big baby and women who went into spontaneous labor later once their baby decided labor was ready, because that's a huge thing. If we wait, the baby decides when to start labor. And so induction is really about saying, we know more than your baby's physiology. And for me, that feels like such an arrogant thing to say, but let me not go down that tangent. If you look at the difference in the weight, it's actually the same weight as a hamster, you know, and or a medium-sized pair. My lovely editor Nadine, when I pointed out that this was the weight of a hamster, she said, well, She said, well, I normally use fruit as an analogy. So that's why I agreed to also say it was a medium-sized pear. But I much prefer saying to women, because it really is for me about getting out information in a way that takes away some of that fear. And, you know, and actually shows, you know, I think it's great if we can show that some of what is being put out there is ridiculous. And so one way I'd like to make it kind of obvious that it's a bit ridiculous is saying, look, the difference is the size of a hamster. If you can push out a baby, I reckon you can manage a little hamster, you know, on top. And you know, that's the difference. And that is the thing. It's, you know, it's the difference is that small. And yet there's all this fear, as Rachel says, all this fear around it.
And actually talking about fruits.
Go on.
Is it true that you were going to put a pumpkin on the front of the book? Please explain.
Well, yes, it was, because I didn't actually put a pumpkin on the final cover. You'll both know this because you both had a draft copy which had a temporary cover, mm-hmm. because you have to make it a cover to print a copy and send it to people to read and give their comments for the back four. Thank you very much, Rachel Reed. And yes, so on the draft copy, I did put a pumpkin on the cover, but my cover designer didn't think it fitted on the final book. So I do have to concede to his greater knowledge in this area. Yeah. So, I mean, I use this analogy a lot. And Julie Froelich, who I mentioned earlier, you know, Julie uses this, and I've quoted Julie in both of my books about this. But yeah, so, I mean, Julie talks to women, and I do as well now, about when she talks about the pros and cons of waiting for induction. And this idea that the technocratic model has tried to sell us of our bodies being unsafe for our babies. So what she says is, look, your baby is not going to turn into a pumpkin at midnight. And this is such a fantastic way of looking at it, because, you know, so I love to point out that babies are not like pumpkins. Nothing happens when the clock strikes midnight, or when you have a birthday and become a year older, or, you know, if you put on 7 or 8 pounds, or, you know, any number of pounds, you know, or when you cross from being 41 weeks to 41 weeks in a minute, you know, nothing happens at that point. Mm. And it's true that the medical model, the obstetric paradigm, may decide that, oh, now that we've crossed this magical point at which midnight is, don't know if you've seen on the book that the clock on the front of the book is pointing at 2 minutes to midnight. That's obviously deliberate. You know, once you cross this imaginary point of midnight in any of these areas, they sort of want to put a different label on you and say, well, now you've fallen into a different risk category. But risk doesn't work like that. And in fact, you know, you've just put on a few pounds, or you've celebrated another birthday. And, you know, it's actually really important. I know I've sort of said this, but I'm going to say it again, that we all get a bit more knowledgeable about some of the deeper issues affecting maternity care and healthcare in general, like risk and how it's used, and like the historical and political and economic issues that underpin what's going on. You know, if we want to make change, it's just so important to understand how we got here and what's going on. So if analogies like pumpkins and putting out slides on pumpkins and talking about hamsters and orangutans can help that, then I'm all for that.
And can I just clarify, a pumpkin isn't actually a fruit, is it? So before everybody starts messaging me telling me that a pumpkin isn't a fruit, I know it's not a fruit, it's a vegetable.
So this is really interesting, because when you said that, my first thought was, oh, is a pumpkin a fruit? And then I thought, this is Rachel Reed. She lives off grid. She's growing vegetables and all sorts. If anybody knows whether a pumpkin is a fruit or a vegetable, it's going to be Rachel Reed. I'll just keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, no, I don't grow anything, even though I'm off grid.
Now I'm going to write in.
We obviously have, we've talked for a long time now, we've covered lots of things, but we haven't even covered half of what you've got going on in this book. Do you want to give us just a very quick what we haven't talked about that's in there for people who are listening?
Oh my goodness. Can I just run you through the chapters? Because I think, because actually, that's a much better way for me of being able to explain what's in there. I've started with, as I said earlier in the podcast, the advantages of spontaneous labour, because we are, as I said earlier, I think always on the back foot about explaining why induction might not be the great idea that some people think it is. So I wanted to start by going, this is why spontaneous labour is so advantageous. And yeah, I've talked about what's behind it, as I've mentioned several times. You know, why doesn't every woman get to birth in her own way? How did we get to where we are? I've looked at the guidelines. I've looked at a whole chapter, and I haven't mentioned this, on listening to women and what the research, there's not much of it, but the research on what women want, because that is being ignored. And sadly, it's being misrepresented by some of those who are writing guidance and speaking out on this area. I've looked at due dates. We haven't talked a lot about due dates. I've looked at due dates, and then also induction in late pregnancy. And what is the evidence around that? Because I think that really needs unpacking. Mm. Can I tell you my favourite chapter title in the whole book is chapter 6 is called "Does My Baby Look Big in This?"
Yes, I like that.
And I was one of my five books. I was going to write a whole book called "Does My Baby Look Big in This?" But I managed to squeeze it into
chapters.
Great
title.
I've then looked at my second favourite chapter is "Too Old, Too Fat, Too Black, Too Risky," where I look at all of the evidence in these areas. I mean, I should say that I'm not looking at the evidence in every area in this book. There's actually only a paragraph for if people are being offered induction for IVF. There's very little I can say about that, sadly. There's one paragraph, and it's not because I don't care about you. It's because there's just no evidence out there. Mm-hmm. So all I can say is I'm ever so sorry. There's no evidence that induction is beneficial. And then I look at some of the solutions at the end. So, you know, those are the chapters. That's my five books in one and a few other bits as well.
So what's next?
Sofa, sitting on the sofa till Christmas. I told you that.
We've heard that one before, though.
Do you know what? Should I tell you what's really next? You can't see this because my webcam is deliberately pointed up and at my face, but I'm not going to move it and show you. But if you know how the thing about and lovely Tricia Anderson, who I've quoted in the book, used to use this analogy all the time about how midwives look all serene. They're like ducks because we look all serene if we're swimming on top of the water, but underneath our little legs are going frantically. Is everything all right? Do I need to do that? Shall I just check this? Mm-hmm. But, you know, well, that's actually how my office looks, because the bit that everybody sees on Zoom is, you know, the top bit where the books are sort of in a row on the shelves. But what you can't see underneath me is that everything in my life that came up sort of before, you know, while I was writing the book, has been made into a pile called "I'll deal with you after I publish in your own time." So actually, even though I pretend I'm going to sit on the sofa, I've actually got to catch up with the rest of my life and all the piles that I've made in my office that I need to attend to.
I was just going to say, I'll have to send us a photograph of your perfectly sorted out office.
Yeah, when
before
it's
and after.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to share the before, if I mean it's all.
And I love that it's called "In Your Own Time," because it's like, I'll deal with that later in my own time. I'll deal with that later. And the thing is, it's when you choose and when you're ready, when your body's ready to, you know, just bring it in these analogies, when your body's ready to birth the cleanliness, you get the signal and you can do it spontaneously.
Yeah.
Just segueing a bit of all those in there. You know?
No, it's fab. But I think there's this thing in our whole culture, isn't there, about convenience and how we've kind of moved towards feeling that we need to have it right away. You know, I'm currently waiting for a pair of boots to arrive, you know, winter boots. And I'm like, I wish they were here, you know. And I wrote the book called In Your Own Time saying, actually, it's not a bad thing to wait. But we have sort of been trained to go, I want this to happen now. So yeah. I'm very much trying to focus on having a slow autumn and winter. That's my plan.
We have a slow food culture, Mm-hmm. We need to have a slow pregnancy culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
There needs to be a movement that comes with really nice casseroles and stews and wintry things, I think. That would also be quite nice.
Cake.
And cake. I mean, who's going to turn down cake? Cake and tea, best thing ever. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we could just say to someone, look, this is, you know, you're at the end of labor, your end of, sorry, pregnancy. It's, you know, it is exhausting for so many women. And if we could just say, here's a bit of cake and a bit of tea, baby's probably going to come in the next few days and I'll come round with a bit of cake and a bit of tea every day and that'll make you feel better. And if it just did the job and we just relaxed, that would be nice.
That is what midwives like Rachel and I do. That is what independent midwifery, holistic midwifery, however it's, you know, caseload midwifery, which can be done really well in the system. We've seen this with the Albany midwifery practice. That's what really good midwifery care can do. Jane Sandal's done some fabulous, and lots of other people as well, have done some fabulous research showing that actually really good midwifery care is a better solution than induction. So you're absolutely mm-hmm. right. And that would be a better solution. Mm. And it's just that for all the boring political and economic reasons, that's not being prioritised. You know, the things that you're talking about, they don't make people money. They're not, no. You know, yeah. I don't want to end on a cynical note.
No, but we don't put value in the power of sitting with someone with a cup of tea, for example, whether that's, for me, that's massive in the postnatal part of, and I've talked about this on other podcasts, like that for me is actually an essential part of my work. But, and it is, it's being with woman and it's listening and it's observing without, and then you individualize because you're able to actually see.
And it's just the being with. And if you are the care provider and you're not freaking out about dates and, mm-hmm. you know, when this baby's going to come, then that helps the woman to relax about dates and when the baby's going to come because it's not an issue. It's not something that's concerning anybody.
Yeah. I would like to go back. You mentioned the beautiful midwife, Tricia Anderson, and a quote she had made, but you actually have a really special quote at the very beginning of your book. And it was really powerful for me. I love animal analogies, and I can see that you do all the way through your book as well. But I really want to read it out as I think this is something that our audience should hear. So if that's okay, I will. This is an article by the midwife, Tricia Anderson, who wrote about what would happen if we took cats into a laboratory to give birth. By means of illustrating the harm that can come from disturbing the hormonal dance of labor. And the quote is, in the laboratory, the laboring cats could hear the sound of the other cats in distress. And there was no private dark corners for them to retreat to, but only rows of brightly lit cages under constant scrutiny of the scientists. And the scientists studied the labouring cats in their brightly lit cages for many years and saw that their labours were erratic, how they slowed down and even stopped, and how heartbreakingly distressed the cats were. Their mews and their cries were terrible. They saw how many of the kittens were deprived of oxygen and were born shocked and needing resuscitation. And after many years, the scientists concluded, well, it seems that cats do not labor very well. Goosebumps. I mean, it's so beautifully written. When we're able to put what we're doing to us as human beings in a perspective of what we would do to animals, and you mentioned this later in the book as well, it is a scary concept. And we need to be thinking clearly about the importance of everything we talk about with so many people throughout the podcast, as well as you, in terms of we need to think cautiously and carefully about induction and what this entails before we just are routinely and randomly allocating this out. And that is exactly what you have spoken throughout this podcast and throughout your book and the blog and critiquing and looking at the guidelines as they are. And I think that is something really important and it's not something to be taken lightly. And we need to be giving women absolutely the real information and being much more aware of the guidelines, where they come from and everything you've said, so that choice can be given. We can be with women, we can individualize care as much as possible, and we can support them to have control over their own bodies and the type of labour and birth that they have.
Absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did. You can find out more about Sarah's work at sarahwickham.com. Go and sign up for her newsletter and receive her monthly birth information update and lots of other good stuff. You will also find Sarah on Instagram at Dr. Sarah Wickham and also on Facebook, Sarah Midwife. And as always, all the links, including where you can find Sarah's new book, In Your Own Time, can be found in the show notes. I say it every time, I know, but please do pop a review for us over on Apple Podcasts, as this really does widen the important messages like we've shared here today. And if you'd like to support the show further, have a look at our Patreon donation page. Deets are in the show notes and, of course, over on our Instagram at The Midwives Cauldron. For as little as half a cup of coffee or a triple espresso macchiato, it's your choice, you could help us bring more of this content to your already tantalised earbuds. Go on, you know you want to. So as always, here you go. The bloopers.
So last time we talked about the Instagram swipe up link, and because Rachel had just got hers and I had to teach her what it was for.
Yeah.
And then a few weeks afterwards, Instagram took away the swipe up link, and I'd only just mastered it and then helped Rachel master it, and they took it away. And then they made it so you can still send people to a link, but you have to press this little button with like a paperclip on. So I couldn't work it out. Right. So I had to DM Amy Brown, because she's 10 years younger than me. Please, can you teach me? And she's like, you just press link. It's not.
But it's not actually a paperclip. It's not a paperclip.
No, it's not really a paperclip.
Oh, I didn't realise that swipe up had gone, and I've seen you using this link thing.
See?
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah, and I hadn't pressed on it because I'm used to a swipe up.
Oh, for God's sake.
Perhaps lots of people don't know to press on it. I don't know. If you're listening and you want to go places, like when we share research, then press the...
It's like a chain link.
Chain link, that's it.
Well, oh God, now I'm not working towards a swipe up button. I'm working towards a blimmin' chain link thing that no one knows about. It could be a paperclip, but no one knows. I think...
And it might be a paperclip by the time you get there.
It'll be something else by the time you get there.
Could be orangutan.
She said it. She said the word.
Yeah, not us. Now it's all right. I feel all right to mention it.
Sarah's been wondering, worrying. We've all been worrying how stressed we are.
You didn't notice.
You put it in your book.
This is the thing. We, Katie and I were talking last night, and we were like, has she noticed? Because she hasn't mentioned it, that I put it in the book. And Katie was going to read you the paragraph and see your face.
That's brilliant.
You mean? You're picking on me.
As soon as I read that, I was like, oh my God, that's in for Rachel. Could have been any animal.
I actually put a quote that I'd said in the last podcast in there as well. I don't know whether you spotted it.
No, what was that?
It was something about there being no correlation between the number of followers that somebody has on social media and the quality of what it is that they have to say.
Please hold on. Didn't happen.
It's like, wow, that's a really small sneeze that Rachel does.
Very ladylike, which isn't normally a word you associate with Rachel Reed.
No, my sneezes are not at all ladylike. Everyone in the house can testify to that. The cats leave the house when I sneeze.
Oh, and I'm like a bit sniffly and don't have any way of escape to get a tissue, so we'll see how we go.
You can just wait.
It's quite going to go and get a tissue to get out. Might have to, but
you really are like a pilot, aren't you? You're trapped in the cockpit.
Look, like this is all around me. This is in shoved in. Then I've got like I'm just gonna do it.
Not as bad as when you made Rachel go in a cupboard though, was it?
Exactly. No sympathy here.
Wish I could see Katie climbing out.
Yep, she's out of the cockpit. She's off. Probably take half an hour to get back in.
Yeah, she's gone to the shops. We didn't realise you had to go to the shops for them, Katie. She can't hear. Of course, because she didn't have my headphones on. Hello, there you are.
I couldn't hear you. No.
We were just saying we didn't realise you had to go all the way to the shops for them.
I'm going to hear it on the playback.
All the things we said about you.
Exactly. You thought you could get away with it, but it's, this podcast is being recorded.
And I think my dinner's ready.
Sorry. Are you getting cold?
No, I can just hear the scraping of the food onto plates.
You're so irreverent. There's Katie, you know, like speaking from the heart about how she feels so moved by the nutritious, lovely analogy, and you're more worried about your dinner.
Sorry.
Wait, well, can I just say, shall I cut that bit or keep it in? Because there was no response.
I know you. You'll bloody keep it in.
Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.